from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, as in previous books, Michael Pollan argues in Cooked that relying on processed food disrupts our link to the natural world and weakens interpersonal relationships. But this time, he takes a more hands-on approach, doing apprenticeships with a variety of culinary masters who teach him the fine points of fermentation, the benefits of bacteria, and other secrets of honest cuisine. He'll join us in studio in the next hour, up ahead, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Author and University of California Berkeley journalism professor Michael Pollan joins us in studio for this Forum second hour. Longtime contributor to the New York Times, who was named by Time magazine back in 2010 as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He's the author of such books as The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, Food Rules, and In Defense of Food. His newest book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. We welcome Michael Pollan back to the Forum program. Good to see you again.
Good to be back, Michael.
Well, where do we begin with this book? Let's begin with sort of the blueprint of this book. You went back to kind of ancient elements, I suppose you could say, fire, water, air, and earth. At least down under the earth, fermentation and all that, and decided to do what a good reporter does or a good Hemingway-esque writer, learn from mentors and apprentice yourself, but also make us realize that each of these elements goes back to really the natural way of how we should be cooking today.
Yeah, you know, this was one of my kind of deep dives to understand how something that we take for granted that's all around us really works, where it came from, what's the anthropology behind it, what's the science behind it, and what's the technique behind it. And I was kind of surprised to find that you could reduce most kinds of cooking, regardless of cuisine, to four basic transformations. And fire being the most obvious, water, cooking in pots, air, baking, and earth, as you said, fermentation. And it was my wife, actually, Judith, who recognized that, hey, they kind of lined up nicely with the classical elements. I don't know why.
Sushi doesn't work here somehow, I guess. That's
No, you're right. Actually, sushi, there, you can find several things that don't fit. It's not a perfect typology, but it's pretty damn close.
And then you went, as I said, you went out and became, well, the mentee. Went first, I guess, to North Carolina and studied with one of the barbecue pit masters and learned all about how that's done. Also brought up some interesting points, how we often associate barbecue, I mean, kind of the culinary finesse of barbecue, with African-Americans.
Yeah, and it has deep roots. The technique appears of cooking over fire, actually in a pit originally with a grate of twigs. The Africans bring to the New World as slaves, picking up some elements in the Caribbean, specifically the hot peppers and the sauces. So it is an African American contribution, although most pitmasters now are white. I worked with a guy named Ed Mitchell in Eastern North Carolina, and he's African American and has a deep sense of the tradition he's working in. Barbecue is very closely tied to the tobacco harvest.
He's the guy who beat Bobby Flay, right?
That's right, in the throwdown.
On the throwdown, the Food Network. And in fact, you make the case pretty strongly that a lot of these food shows are keeping us away from, well, we'll get into your argument because it is kind of a polemic that we should be in the kitchen ourselves.
Well, yeah, and I think all the food journalism, the whole fetishization of food on television and everywhere in our culture actually is having a deleterious effect on cooking. It's making people intimidated. I mean, when you watch cooking on a primetime Food Network show with knives flashing and fountains of flame and a clock ticking down the seconds, I mean, this looks like work best left to professionals. And so I actually think these shows are, rather than motivating us to get off the couch, they're actually pinning us to the couch and making us feel we're inadequate.
Well, many people's minds, they want to leave it to the professionals. I'm wondering about this. In fact, I bet you you've gotten some blowback on this already, the idea that I could hear somebody saying, you know, here's this privileged, well-off Berkeley foodie who's making me feel guilty about not being in the kitchen and not doing cooking when, in fact, you know, I start work at 7, I get off at 7, and, you know, I'm going out there and I'm getting healthy foods because the food companies are making healthy foods for me. Not entirely, of course, but to
Well, a couple points about that. First of all, I'm not interested in making anyone feel guilty. This is not an argument or I'm not trying to lecture people into the kitchen. I'm trying to entice them into the kitchen by showing them how interesting and pleasurable it can be. And I think that we've convinced ourselves that cooking is drudgery. Sometimes it is, but sometimes that's a matter of outlook and how you approach it and what you know about the work that goes on there. I approach cooking as a leisure activity as much as anything, as a really rewarding way to spend time. And it took me a while to get in that head because I used to be kind of impatient in the kitchen. When I chopped an onion, I kind of chunked it up and sautéed it for a few minutes and couldn't wait to put the next ingredient in if I were cooking. I was only interested in making 20-minute meals. And we all have a time crunch. There's no question. Americans work too hard, and there's a deep history of that. You know, our labor movement fought for money. In Europe, they fought for time. So we made a trade-off. And in Europe, they still cook a lot more. And in Europe, they don't have our rates of obesity. These things are all connected. And as you know, time spent in the kitchen is less time probably spent in the doctor's office down the road. And but I understand the difficulty of doing it, and it's a real thing. We need policies to make it easier for people to cook. You know, in Northern Europe, you can share jobs, you can go to three quarters time for the first 8 years of your kid's life. There are many. There's very good parental leave, longer vacations, shorter work week. And we need to fight for policies that allow us to do this essential work. And I do regard home cooking as essential work. There is no better predictor of a healthy diet than that it be home cooked.
Well, you also point out, and it's a very good point, that we somehow find the time a couple hours a day for the internet, or we find the time to work out. So why not find the time when cooking can be ritual? It can be, you should forgive the choice of this word, spiritually processing for some people.
It is. I mean, I found it, there is a spiritual dimension to cooking. It connects you to the natural world and these other species that you're working with, and it connects you to other people. And, you know, your point about going out and getting healthy food from corporations, so far the evidence is not very good that corporations, that industrial cookery can be done well. We don't have many examples of corporations cooking healthy food. They tend to use the cheapest raw ingredients they can get away with and then dress it up with lots of salt, fat, and sugar.
Additives, too.
And additives, to, yeah. Because this food was cooked so long ago and far away that they need additives.
Did you see the article by Gina Collado recently about how salt is not necessarily as deleterious as we thought?
I did. And I think that's very interesting. I think we've... you know, it's our history of demonizing specific nutrients. And the fact is we do get a lot of salt in processed food, and there was a range that was bigger than we thought for a healthy amount of salt. But many of us are way out of that range. And corporations love salt because it's very cheap, and it's one of those evolutionary buttons they like to push along with sugar and fat.
Well, you use the word outsourcing, and I think probably people do outsource to industrial corporate foods too much and would benefit certainly, as you said, health and have enhanced greater health by making their own food or in the kitchen and so forth.
Or making a little more than they're making now. You know, it's not an all or nothing proposition. It's not like you got to cook seven times. I don't do that. I mean, you know, I do it as often as I can. You have to meet people where they are. And even if you add one cooked meal to whatever you're doing now this week, you're striking a blow for the health of your family and for the health of the food system, by the way. Because when we let corporations cook, we support the kind of agriculture that those corporations buy from, which is huge monocultures and feedlots.
Which I want to talk about the Farm Bill, in fact, with you. But look, the corporations are easy targets. I'm just thinking about the fact that probably because of people like you, they're getting much more – I mean, you have Amy's Organics and things like this, you know, Amy's Kitchen. I mean, where they're trying to do things in step with what has been a creation of different consciousness in the consumer because – people write about food like you.
Yeah, and I look forward to a day where they get it all worked out and learn how to cook healthy food. They have some fundamental problems that get in the way. It's a very hard business to make money, and the margins are really tiny. And they are, as Michael Moss demonstrated in his book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat, if I have the order right of the
I think that's right, yeah.
Since the population is growing at a slower rate than Wall Street requires that they grow, the only way they can do it is by more and more processing and inducing us to eat more and more of their food. So their business model is in conflict with our biology fundamentally. And there may be companies like Amy's that will figure out another business model. And I hope so. I hope we have a healthy fast food chain at some point. But if you want any control over your diet right now, you need to take back that control of your diet. You need to decide how much salt, fat, and sugar is going to be in your food, not let a corporation do that, because they're not going to make decisions in your best interest.
You also got, seems to me, some dander up from the feminists, or at least some feminists in this recent book, and it goes back to other work that you've done where you say Betty Friedan kind of chased women out of the kitchen and all that, and some women are striking out in different articles saying, come on, it didn't really happen that way with the second wave of feminism. In fact, some of the analysis I've read have said it was really a class situation much more. You know, your mother may have been in the kitchen. My mother may have been in the kitchen. But most of the privileged, wealthy people didn't have mothers in the kitchen. They had people who were cooking for them. And I guess
had I dwelled on that case, I would have been accused of elitism. I'm not interested in people with maids. I mean, this is a small percentage. There was one piece that suggested in the 19th century, which I wasn't writing about, that lots of people had maids, so my history was bad. My history was absent in that case. The feminist argument is,
let me frame it a different way, actually, okay. And just get your response to it. Because what I was reading was you talk about Kentucky Fried Chicken in the 70s having a slogan, women's liberation, and all, and suddenly the food companies are jumping all over this because they see opportunity with women no longer being in the kitchen and women going out, having to be part of the workforce because of the changing economy. But so the food industry clearly capitalized on that. I mean, there's no argument there. I guess the argument from some of the women that I've been reading is that there was processed food right after World War II, for example, part of World War II and everything. It wasn't as if the food industry was just doing this because women were moving out of the kitchen.
No. And the story in the book is a little more careful than the account that's around. But as you say, the food industry has been trying to insinuate itself into our kitchens for more than 100 years. It goes before World War II. It was Betty Crocker. That was the first wave, in a way, of getting us to use processed food. Less processed than the food we have now. These are kind of single, first-order processed foods with just a couple ingredients. And after World War II, they redoubled their efforts. And the reason is that they had invented all these cool things like instant coffee and dehydrated foods and powdered orange juice or concentrated orange juice. And they were pushing really, really hard and actually finding a lot of resistance from women. The marketers checked it out, and women would say, no, this is the part of housework we like. This is the creative outlet. And so for a long time, Laura Shapiro's told this story in Something from the Oven. You know, when they sold cake mixes in the 50s, when they introduced this just add water cake mix, they were roundly rejected. And they went back to the drawing board and they found, and the reason they were rejected is women couldn't take ownership of a cake that they'd only added water to and stuck in the oven. So then they said, well, let's take out the powdered egg and we'll ask women to actually crack open an egg and see if they feel differently about it. And miraculously, they did. They could own a cake that they had cracked open the egg for or put in the little packet of chocolate syrup or whatever it is. But there was a lot of resistance to industrialized food in the kitchen of whole meals. And what the industry did, I mean, this story gets told as, that I'm suggesting that feminism led to the collapse of cooking. And that's not the story. The story is that the food industry exploited feminism to work its way into the kitchen. Basically, what Betty Friedan was asking for was a renegotiation of the division of labor in the house, which we needed to do in the 60s and 70s. I'm sure you, like me, was party to some of those very tense, uncomfortable conversations. And they were unfolding across dinner tables across America. And rather than work that out, that conversation was in effect aborted when industry said, stop arguing. We've got you covered. We'll do the cooking. And they started using feminist rhetoric to sell processed food. And it was a relief to everybody that we could stop arguing and just take our kids out for fast food or use TV dinners or whatever it was. And you find an acceptance of processed food driven in part by the fact that, yeah, there were time constraints and women could not be expected to do all the housework. So it's, you know, it's a more complicated argument than is than floats around on the web, as usual. You know, I mean, it's I'm not surprised.
Our guest is Michael Pollan. His new book is Cooked. And there's a guy you write about, a lot of people you write about, actually, when I get into some of these larger-than-life personalities, like a cheesemaker up in Litchfield, Connecticut. And
but there's Sister guy, Noella, yeah.
Yeah. But there's also a guy who is kind of a consumer guru, and he sort of flatly says, well, people have been cheap and lazy about cooking their own food. They're going to continue to be.
Yeah. This is Harry Balzer, and he's a character in the book who is a really hard-bitten Chicago marketing consultant. His whole career has been basically helping the industry sell us more processed food. He's very cynical on the future of cooking. He thinks in the next generation or two, people will look at what we think of as scratch cooking or roasting a chicken or something like that, the way we look at baking bread or making your own beer. I mean, that it will be – or going out and chasing down a chicken and capturing it and killing it and cooking it. It'll be as exotic as that. I hope he's wrong. And I think he probably is wrong. But his argument is that the reason we don't cook is simply because we don't have to, and that we outsource what we can because we're cheap and lazy. I'm sure that's true for some people. On the other hand, he says something very interesting, and this is a bit of wisdom.
It's kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, well, it is.
We're cheap and lazy.
Well, you know, if you study marketing long enough, I think you acquire a pretty dim view of human nature. I think it's the nature of the
work. Goes with the territory, yeah.
But he also told me something very interesting, because I was saying, well, what about the obesity epidemic? I mean, all this processed food is making people sick, and which he will acknowledge. And he said, let me tell you the diet for America. This is the one diet that would work. And I took out my pad, and I was eager to write this
down.
Eat
food, mostly plants, not too much?
No, it was different. Actually, he surprised me. It was eat anything you want as long as you cook it yourself. See, he understands really well it's who's doing the cooking that determines the quality of the diet.
So you're not proselytizing here.
Well, look, I am. What I'm trying to suggest is we have a powerful choice. People are going to make it or not make it, but what I'm trying to show in this book is the rewards, the deep rewards, both practical and philosophical and spiritual, of getting back into the kitchen. That it has a lot to offer us, and that it's very pleasurable. You know, I mean, I would love to see a revival of home cooking. And there's some positive evidence out there. Contra Harry Balzer, the numbers have ticked up a little since 2008. That may have to do with the economy because it is cheaper to cook. I mean, we forget. As cheap as processed food is, there's nothing more economical than cooking it yourself.
I said I wanted to just get your take on the Farm Bill because the debates are going on. In fact, I was reading Food First. They were talking about agribusiness and commodity interests continuing to divide food and farming policy. But we've got, for example, now, say, corn and soy farmers, and they're forbidden, actually, to grow anything other than because of the subsidies.
That's right.
It's got to change, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that one will change. I think that it's just unconscionable that if you receive subsidies to grow commodity crops, including corn and soy, you're not allowed to grow specialty crops, which is our odd term for food that people can actually eat. This is a specialty. But that idea, as it receives more public scrutiny, is just untenable. Defended, by the way, historically by Nancy Pelosi in defense of the California delegation. And the people growing specialty crops don't want competition from people growing broccoli in the Midwest. They want to grow it all. But I think that will fall. And we're moving to a different model of subsidies, which is to say away from direct subsidies for growing particular crops to crop insurance. Is this a better or worse thing? Well, the way it's been designed right now, crop insurance is not a better thing. I mean, we are essentially on the hook for really bad decisions being made by farmers. There's no disincentive to plant corn in areas likely to be struck by drought because we're going to pick up the cost if you blow it. So I think we need to attach to crop insurance certain standards so that, you know, of conservation, of not planting in places where you shouldn't plant these crops. And we also need to redesign crop insurance, which right now is very, very much directed toward monocultures, so that you could get crop insurance for diversified farming. And that proposal is on the table right now. Shelley Pingree, who's a congresswoman from Maine and on the House Appropriations Committee for Ag, is promoting a very progressive idea that would offer crop insurance to people, you know, like the truck farmers that serve our farmers markets that are doing many different crops, and so that the whole farm could be insured. So there's some positive things nibbling around the edges. But as usual, it's going to be a terrible farm bill. And they'll buy off the critics with a couple good plans and programs. And that the kinds of change we need to see in our agricultural policies, you know, we're not going to see it this year.
You've had a prediction from Michael Pollan. And by the way, you have an opportunity to speak to him. Any questions or comments you might have, we certainly welcome your involvement in this discussion and invite you to join us. Let me tell you how you can do that. If you have something you'd like to say or go on the record with, question or comment, you can call us now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's, again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. And you can also join the conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, and Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org. But we do welcome your involvement. Michael Pollan's new book, again, is Cooked. And you can also read the introduction of Michael Pollan's new book, Cooked, on our website, kqed.org/forum. And click on this segment. Kind of a funny question, but you become, you know, let's face it, kind of an iconic figure to many people, and maybe even more of a rock star in some respects. And, you know, you've always come across to me as just a hardworking journalist and, you know, a guy who has some sense of self-possession and some, well, humility even. At least that's the outer persona. Some of this infiltrate and get to you at times? Like, I mean, you tell us how good microbes are for us. I was thinking about that in the same context as a metaphor, you know, the bacteria that can get into you when you become, you know, kind of in the limelight so much.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it hasn't changed the way I go about my everyday life. I'm perhaps a little more self-conscious in the supermarket because sometimes people are watching when I'm buying. But, you know, I don't hang out with people who think of me as an icon.
Very smart.
And I have a son who doesn't think of me as an icon and a wife who doesn't think of me as an icon. So
you have a brother-in-law, too, who is an icon, and that's Michael J. Fox.
And amazingly, has an amazing sense of humility and doesn't walk around thinking he's an icon.
We haven't talked a little bit. We want to talk a little bit about fermentation, actually. I think we kind of teased it a bit, but we only got a minute here. When we're talking about fermentation, we're talking about just the whole earth and how it plays its role into our natural food eating and food making processes.
Well, you know, to me, the most miraculous journey I took was learning about this kind of cooking that is done without any heat whatsoever. It's done strictly by microbes, bacteria and fungi, who can transform food, make it much more flavorful, much more nutritious, and often kind of weird. I mean, you know, very, very odd, strong flavors. And we've been doing this for as long as we've been eating. And learning about the microbiology, this is an invisible realm that I had never really dealt with as a writer. And I'm in pretty deep now.
Did a whole piece in New York Times Magazine, I saw.
Yeah, this Sunday, yeah. There's a fermentation outside us, and then there's a fermentation within us. And they're both really important to our health.
Microbes are our friends, though.
Some of
in
my
most
best friends are bacteria.
Yeah, well, I have to keep that in mind because they're probably the ones that are going to survive more than we will on this planet, at least.
No question.
Talking to Michael Pollan, and when we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Michael Pollan. His new book is Cooked, and he is the author of many bestsellers, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, Food Rules, and In Defense of Food. I think we have discussed every book you've written on this program, have we not?
No, I think you missed one. You wouldn't have me on for one of them.
Come on. Are you serious? Nah, it's a joke. What do you think about, We'll get to our callers here in just a moment. What do you think about, you know, Google and Twitter and all these companies where they actually have all the food available?
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of home cooked, or one could argue that there's a kind of quasi home cooking to it. But, you know, it's the best produce and all that sort of thing. And they keep their young people there, not only the young people, but even the older employees, because they have all that food available.
Well, it keeps them on campus.
And that's what I mean. What yeah, doing. So they yeah. get more hours
out of
it.
It's very clever.
Right?
They, I mean, I haven't been to all those corporate campuses. I have been on the Google campus where the food is quite good.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are these little snack places where you can get a smoothie or a cereal bar at any hour, which I would imagine be a kind of a dangerous temptation. They're trying. They're trying to source their food very carefully, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Talk about, just before we go to calls here too, you did a microwave experiment.
Yeah.
It has to do, again, with the question that many of us think about when we think about doing our own cooking, which is all the time that it's going to suck out of our lives. But talk about that microwave.
Well, it was kind of surprising. We were kind of testing, you know, well, let's try convenience food for a night, and let's see how convenient it really is and what it really costs and how it tastes. So my son cooked up this idea, and that was we would go to the supermarket, and we would each get a microwavable entree. And he got two, actually. He got a French onion soup gratiné made by Safeway, and he got a P.F. Chang's Shanghai stir-fry beef, and I got an Amy's vegetarian curry, and my wife got a lasagna from Stouffer's, and we proceeded to cook it, with quotation marks around that word, which meant microwaving it. But the microwave is such an individualistic appliance that you can only do one at a time. And so it actually took about 40 minutes to get this convenience meal on the table. And by the time the fourth entree came out of the microwave, the first one was cold and had to be reheated. And we spent the entire meal, each of us having to get up from the table to reheat their food. And so it took 40 minutes. It cost $27. And you could buy a perfectly good farmer's market meal for $27. And how did it taste? Well, you can imagine, a lot like airline food, if you can remember what that was like.
One wants to repress the memory of airline food, at least this one does. Let me get our callers on here. Our first caller is Spinner. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I basically enjoyed everything that your guest has said. I cook for a living, and a lot of it is scratch cooking. I was just thinking, you know, I didn't know a lot about this until I actually got into the kitchen and started working for a living. And I was thinking about my childhood, and I just remembered that what the stuff that they were giving in the lunch cafeterias, and you can watch cartoons on any Saturday, and it's nothing but box cereal, sugar, and colors and preservatives. And I think that as children, we form our bad habits of eating, and, you know, we don't want to eat our broccoli. We'd rather have pizza, da-da-da-da-da. And by the time we, you know, grow up, we're already predisposition to diabetes, obesity, you know, all kinds of maladies. And I just wanted to see if he had ever seen the video Yuck or Cafeteria Man. And I can take my thing off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call.
I have seen Cafeteria Man. I mean, I think school food is an important part of the problem and potentially the solution. You know, I remember school food as – I actually liked school food at the time. It was still being – scratch cooked. It wasn't all just being reheated. And I remember coming home and asking my mom if she could make a Salisbury steak or some of these things that we were eating. And she tried her best to imitate school food. But right now, though, you know, the default in school food has been very fatty fried foods, lots of pizza, lots of French fries. And you're right. I mean, our kids' taste buds are being trained by this food, and you develop a very high threshold for things like salt and fat. And I think improving school food is an important step to changing the way Americans eat, without question. And also, I think teaching home ec again. I mean, we used to teach cooking skills in schools.
High schools had home ec classes for almost every girl in my high school.
But that was the problem, almost every girl. And in my school, too. And boys could take home ec, but we generally took shop. We weren't confident enough in our 12-year-old sense of our masculinity to take a cooking class. I think we have an opportunity, though, to have a non-gendered home ec with a better name right now, and that kids, boys, are not as indoctrinated with the idea that cooking is women's work and that we could have a non-sexist culture of cooking.
Come on, most chefs are men still, aren't they?
Well, that's right. Most chefs are men, and you see these macho guys on the Food Network shows who, you know, act and preen like athletes. And, you know, my son grew up thinking that cooking was, you know, a perfectly great male occupation. And so I think we have an opportunity that we didn't have a few decades ago.
Some good recipes in this book, too. You know, I mean, it's become we just had on Mark Bittman, and I remember when Jacques Pepin went on the air with us, his last book. I mean, the idea of getting recipes that you can do quickly again, but healthy, and you can do whip up in the kitchen. Also some good stories in here. I never knew that Charles Lamb thing about the that Chinese thing about the...
The discovery of cooking, yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
You tell that? I mean, it's just
a dissertation on roast pig. Well, Charles Lamb claims that cooking was discovered by a Chinese peasant, a boy, who had... was keeping a litter of pigs and accidentally burned down his house and with the pigs in it. And he went to rescue the pigs, and they were already kind of
cooked.
And he reached down and he touched the skin of one of them and then touched it to his lip and tasted crackling for the first time in human history. And it's quite a taste if you haven't ever had it. Bacon gives you some idea, but it's only an idea of how good it is. And then his father came home and was really angry at him for burning down the house. But he said, no, Dad, you have to try this. And his father tried it and said, oh, this is amazing. So they set about building a new house, putting pigs in it and burning that down as a way to cook pigs. And for many years, architecture languished as people would burn down whole houses to dress pigs.
And this may be the story of the three little pigs. Blow that house down.
The Chinese version. Eventually, they learned how to cook pigs without burning down houses, which is a great advance for our civilization.
Listener writes on our website, as a cooking teacher, I totally agree that home cooking is best. You can control your ingredients. The most rewarding part is cooking and eating with your family. Priceless. I've been making kimchi, but instead of brining first, I use vinegar, which helps it break down much faster so I can eat it sooner. Yum. You're a big advocate of family eating together.
Well, look, cooking and family meals go together. I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble to cook a meal, you're not going to let your kids run off and eat it in front of the television. You're all going to sit down together. And the family meal is, I mean, this sounds overblown, but I think it's the nursery of democracy. I mean, I think the things that our kids learn at the table are so essential. They learn how to share. They learn how to take turns. They learn how to argue without fighting. They learn the art of conversation. And where else are they going to get this if not at the family dinner table?
I just keep remembering my brother making faces at me mainly.
Well, and there was a lot of that. And we did have a certain amount of fighting and screaming, but that's where we were civilized. And it can be a very difficult interaction for young kids. But they learn critical life skills at the table. And if everyone's eating processed food, as we found in our microwave meal, that becomes a very disjointed eating experience. I'm also convinced that eating from the same pot, sharing food, puts us on the same emotional page. I have no research to back this up. It would be an interesting thing to study. But food and mood are very closely related. And the chemicals that you ingest with food do affect your mood in various different ways. And so I think sharing food is a powerful binding force that we overlook.
Denise writes, cooking is not a chore when properly done. It is a celebration you get to enjoy three times a day. And yes, I was a working mom who raised three kids, one of whom went on to become a Cordon Bleu chef. Another listener says, I never enjoyed cooking until I became a vegan. Touching dead fish, pig's ribs, and other animal body parts disgusted me, but I didn't realize then that it wasn't necessary. What is missing from the fire, air, water, earth elements discussion regarding cooking is our ethical obligation to the animals involved. I'm saddened that Mr. Pollan's articulate focus on food omits awareness of the lives and deaths of the animals we are breeding, confining, and killing for food, however humanely we think we are doing it.
Well, actually, there is a discussion of ethical meat eating in the book. And one of my challenges...
You roasted a whole hog, in fact.
Several, in fact. But part of my exploration of barbecue was looking for a pitmaster who actually cared where the pork came from. And most of them don't. And they use, you know, the worst commodity hogs. And but I found one, Ed Mitchell, who did and worked very hard with small farmers who were humanely raising pigs. So... You know, ethical eating is never far from my concerns. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, but I have enormous respect for people who are or are vegans because they've done something most people haven't done, which is work out the thought process, the implications of their cooking and eating choices. And they just come out in a different place than I do. But having gone through that thought process and having that consciousness about what's at stake, that's all I can ask for from anybody.
Well, it's not only animals and protection of animals and those who love animals. It's also the environment. If you eat meat, you're contributing in a negative way. And I say this as a carnivore.
Yeah, no question. I mean, the carbon footprint of meat eating is a tremendous part of the climate change problem. It represents between 20%, according to the UN, of climate change problem is due to meat eating. And there's no question that we all eat way too much meat, 9 ounces per person per day in this country. If the rest of the world decides they want to eat those quantities of meat, we're screwed.
We can't sustain it. And you're still on the side of organic food, even though we've got people like Bruce Ames and others who say, it may cost more, but that's about all the advantage you get out of it. It's just as deleterious.
Bruce makes a good point. If you're concerned about your health, it's more important that you simply eat vegetables and fruit than worry about it being organic. And if health is what's driving your choice, don't get hung up on organic. You can eat a very healthy diet that's not organic. Frozen vegetables are terrific. Canned tomatoes, all these kind of things, whether they're organic or not, represent a big step up from eating processed food.
You like frozen produce, in fact.
I do. Yeah, I always have frozen spinach and peas in my
even though
my
you freezer. Have that growing garden?
I do, but you don't always have spinach in the garden. And I use frozen vegetables all the time. But I do support organic for environmental reasons, and they're really good environmental reasons. I mean, Bruce's focus is on the pesticide residues. I'm somewhat more alarmed than he is about pesticide residues. But his general point that we should be stressing produce and not keeping people from eating produce because they're afraid of the pesticides on it.
Andy from Redwood City says, what are you having for lunch today? How do you manage to try to cook for yourself when you're traveling so much? Of course, you're not alone. How can frequent travelers take better care of themselves with regard to food?
Well, travel is really tough. And I've been on the road, talking about the virtues of home cooking and eating in restaurants every single night for about a month. So as I said earlier, you do what you can. Someday somebody will invite me over after a book event for a home cooked meal. But it hasn't happened yet. In terms of what I'm having for lunch, I'm having leftovers. I think that one of the keys to cooking, to dealing with the time problem, is make twice as much as you plan to eat. And I do that whenever I can. If I'm roasting a chicken, I roast two. One of the keys to dealing with the time problem, I think, is making a couple things at once. It's not any harder to make two chickens than one. It's no more dishes to clean up. And then you've got the basis of another meal. So when one meal can roll into the next in some ways, that, I think, is how we deal with the time problem. Tamar Adler has a wonderful book about this called The Everlasting Meal. And it really is about how one meal nourishes the next.
You become a much better cook as a result of all this.
Well, I hope so.
Does that mean you become short order maybe or do something on the side in the culinary world?
I think my teachers would tell you I'm not quite ready for that if they were here. But I have gotten better, and in large part because I've learned how to kind of relax into the process. One of my teachers is a Berkeley chef named Samin Nosrat, and she takes yoga quite a bit seriously. And she said, the key to cooking is patience, practice, and presence. And I was really bad at all three of those. I'm not a spiritually well-developed person. But when I learned that and learned when chopping onions, just chop onions – to not fight against the time in the kitchen, always thinking there's something more important to do, to let yourself be when you're there, becomes a real practice. And I enjoy it in a way I didn't. And I let the onions saute now for 30 minutes, 40 minutes.
I think you're a prime candidate for Spirit Rock now. Here's Jillian who tweets, cooking is one part of the healthy solution, but for many poor people, there's no access to a kitchen. Good point.
Yeah, well, I agree that food security, which we've defined to mean adequate amounts of food, and lately we have redefined to mean access to fresh produce, Michelle Obama's whole initiative to deal with food deserts. I think as we solve that problem, we discover another one, which is you can bring fresh produce to people, but they often don't have the skills to deal with it, and the fresh produce languishes in their fridge. So I believe we have to redefine food security to include having the skills and the basic equipment to cook. And the equipment's pretty basic. I mean, with a knife and a cast iron pan, you're pretty, and a cutting board, you're pretty far down the road. I mean, I think we can put this in people's hands. But overlooking the cooking piece is leading to some real disappointment in the food security movement.
A listener asks, if we're all eating horrible processed food that is allegedly killing us, why do people in countries that eat the most of it live longer now than they did 50 years ago?
Well, our lifespan has gone up. It has nothing to do with our diet. It has to do with
medical technology, mainly.
It has to do with, I mean, if you look at it, it's all infant mortality and surviving the first 5 years of life. Anywhere on the planet, if you can survive those years, you're going to live a long time.
I was thinking of the end of life, though. I mean,
well,
we're
and
just extending it.
We've added a few years at the end also. But what's killing us are chronic diseases linked to diet. And if we could deal with that, that would have a dramatic effect on life expectancy. I'm talking about type 2 diabetes. I'm talking about heart disease, a whole set of cancers linked to diet. All the chronic diseases of inflammation we are learning are closely tied to the way we're eating.
Carol writes, let us remember that Julia Child wrote her famous tomes for The Servantless American Cook. Because Julia grew up with all her cooking being done by servants.
Well, you know, look, if you can afford to pay a human to cook for you, more power to you. I mean, that's not the audience I'm particularly interested in addressing. But the key is having a human cook. It doesn't have to be you. Someone you employ can do a perfectly good job, I'm sure.
Because a lot of people have a different meaning that they attach. It's like one of those floating signifiers that the Derrida writes about when they think about a home-cooked meal. I mean, there's extraordinary. So, I mean, you and I have talked about the fact that we didn't necessarily, as much as you talk about and lionize the meals that were made years ago and are ago, we didn't necessarily get healthy meals, particularly our grandparents and the like.
Yeah, although, you know, from what we're learning, those meals with all their, you know, chicken fat, you're talking about the Jewish tradition, they don't look as bad as they did for a while when we were demonizing fat and saturated fat. You know, the research linking saturated fat to heart disease has completely fallen apart. So, you know, our grandmothers may have been onto something that the cardiologists missed.
The listener writes, last time I heard Michael interviewed, he said he was going to stop writing about food because he was afraid of being pigeonholed. Actually, when I think when you started this book, I said, well, what's the next book on it? You said bread. Yeah, you did. I mean, you were, I guess, thinking of it in maybe an entirely different...
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I go through these, you know, this process of experimentation when I'm deciding what to write about and where my interest goes. And you know, I'm surprised I'm still writing about food. But the reason is that food turns out not to be a subject. It's almost a medium. You can write about so much through writing about food. You can write about the economy. You can write about power. You can write about Washington. You can write about science. And so each book I've managed to find a subject where I'm sufficiently an idiot. In other words, I don't know much that I can tell the story of my education.
There's the pollen humility that I alluded to before, calling himself an idiot. We asked on Facebook, how realistic is it for you to get a homemade meal on the table? Laura writes, does a peanut butter and jelly sandwich count? Jan says, only if they can be accomplished in 20 minutes, preferably less in a teensy kitchen. Diane writes, doesn't take more than 30, 45 minutes to cook a healthy, delicious meal from scratch. Simple foods, simply prepared, are the key. The time it takes for my rice to cook is the time it takes for the balance, including prep. Also, crock pots and pressure cookers can speed things along. It doesn't need to be French laundry every night.
Well, and I think that's right. And it's a very important point. We've confused restaurant food with normal food. And we sort of feel if we can't cook restaurant food, we don't know how to cook. And that's not true. Restaurant food is special occasion food. It's not everyday food. Look, there are wonderful recipes for, and Mark Bittman has this base covered, to get food on the table in 20 minutes. And there are strategies for doing it that often involve cooking a couple things on a Sunday, for example. So, you know, if you start the week with a couple meals in the refrigerator, you're in really good shape if you do have to work late or you're too tired or whatever it is. I think we have to be strategic. I think, you know, it isn't easy. I sympathize with the difficulty of, you know, when both partners work a long day, getting food on the table can be challenging. But look at the alternatives and look how long it takes to, you know, to order the takeout, go get it, come back, wait online, wait in front of the microwave, watching the carousel rotate your frozen block of dinner, feeling useless. You know, how much time are you really saving? And look at the rest of your life, too. You know, we make time to get to the gym or the yoga class because it's so important to our health and our sanity. My argument is that if you start cooking, you will find it is just important to your health and your sanity.
Let me bring another caller on here. And from the home base for Michael of Berkeley, Scott, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll second Mr. Krasny, but Mr. Pollan, I'm a huge fan of you too. And my first question is, when?
Sorry for the previous
Michael for dual purposes here. Yeah.
Mr. Pollan, when are you teaching another class in Berkeley?
I'm scheduled to teach this fall. I'm teaching
really?
a food writing workshop. Yeah.
There you go, Scott.
Can I get
sign
the
up.
Class number real quick.
I don't know the class number. I'm sorry. You have
to
go to the Journalism School website.
Another caller. Kate,
I think
that's
you have to be enrolled also.
Hi, Kate. You're on. No? Okay. Then let me go to Tracy next. Tracy, go ahead.
Hi, Michael. I want to hear you expressly attribute some responsibility to fathers because you said in the 50s and 60s, we could no longer expect mothers to cook, and mothers were too worn out to argue, battle with their husbands to get them to cook. And so I'd really like to hear you take it off of the mother's burden and expressly state that we couldn't expect fathers to cook at that time. And what are your expectations now for fathers to cook? Can we expect fathers to cook, and should they?
Without question. I mean, we have to bring everybody into the kitchen. We have to bring men and women and, most importantly, kids. I think we're really giving our kids a real pass on chores these days because we're so concerned about their success in school. And they tell us they have a lot of homework and we back right off. So, no, we need to get everybody in the kitchen, not just for reasons of equity, although those are important, but because there is so much for them to gain by being there.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Michael Pollan. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to some more listener comments here. Here's Leandra from El Sobrante who says, so much of our food is pre-processed now, spaghetti sauce, dried noodles, breadcrumbs. Where do you draw the line? What makes the most impact to our health?
Well, I think that's a good point. You know, there's a huge world of difference between a can of tomatoes and a bottle of spaghetti sauce, even though those might seem like a very narrow choice. But look at the ingredients. The can of tomatoes has one or two ingredients, and the spaghetti sauce has a dozen. And has lots of sugar and lots of salt. To go in the kitchen from that can of tomatoes to a really satisfying tomato sauce really involves an onion. That's basically it. And we can do this ourselves. And the result is, again, we get more control over how much salt, fat, and sugar we're ingesting. So there are two kinds of processed food. There's processed food, which is one or two ingredients. And then there's what I call ultra-processed or hyper-processed food. These are ones with 5, 10, 20, 30 ingredients. Those are the ones to watch out for.
As you say, when you talk about food, you get into public policy, you get into so many different facets, anthropology and so forth. I just want to read a couple of emails here that, like Terry says, I think the food stamp program would be enhanced if it required recipients to attend educational events showing how to eat more healthy and economically by cooking from scratch. Many people probably didn't grow up in homes where cooking from scratch was the norm. If we taught a generation of food stamp recipients how to cook from scratch and eat dinner as a family, the benefits would be amazing. And Dave says, while I have great admiration for Michael Pollan, having read his work, I was surprised to hear his definition of where the barbecue method of cooking comes from. Most etymologists believe that barbecue derives ultimately from the word
barbacoa.
Yeah, found in the language of the Taino people of the Caribbean. Well, you did mention the Caribbean.
Right, I did.
The word translates as sacred fire pit and is also spelled barbacoa or barbacoa.
Yeah, I'm just saying how it got here via the Caribbean and that the slaves who stopped or spent time in the Caribbean picked up the technique from the Caribbean Indians.
Riyadh writes, I love your books and you've helped me learn a lot about food, but I have not heard you drawing the strong connection between the built environment and health. I tend to think the obesity epidemic is as much a product of what we put in our mouths as how much we are moving. The car-dependent communities we live in are as much, if not even more, to blame for our health.
Well, let me say something about that. I mean, yes, in general, and there was a time when we could eat everything we're eating without a problem, which is to say when we were doing physical labor. The cane cutters in Cuba consume 6,000 calories of sugar a day as they work, and they don't get type 2 diabetes because they're burning it all off. However, the obesity epidemic can be explained and accounted for without any change in physical activity. In other words, we're eating enough additional calories since 1980 to explain the entire weight gain. The research on whether we're more or less sedentary since 1980 is very equivocal. There are studies in both directions. We've also had an exercise fad since 1980. So as important as exercise is for our health, for our weight, it does not appear to be right now the key factor driving the obesity epidemic. It is the factor that the industry would like us very much to focus on.
Couple tough questions here. I'm going to pair them together. Bob writes on our website, I've tried fermenting. The big problem is it doesn't taste good. Quite the opposite. Please don't try the old song and dance that your taste buds will change. Nope, mine are cantankerous. What's the point of eating if it doesn't taste good? I'll stick with fire, water, and air. And then another listener writes,
fine with me.
What do you suggest for people who aren't inspired or gratified by cooking at all? I enjoy my home-cooked meals, but a lot of times making them is a drag.
Yeah, you know, look, there are people for whom this isn't going to work. And, you know, that's fine. I don't think, you know, I'm proposing a blanket solution for everybody's issues. And I find, even though I had resistance to cooking and was very impatient in the kitchen, I found that if I approached it in the right spirit, it became incredibly enjoyable. For me, that right spirit involves things like understanding the science of an onion and why is it fighting back when you cut it. When I know that, the process becomes instantly more stimulating intellectually. So, you know, it takes different things for different people. And there's some people don't like gardening either, and they're never going to do it. And that's fine.
Another listener writes, there's evidence that evolution gave humans a brain that is as large as it is because our recent hominid ancestors overcame the hurdle of eating only uncooked food and graduated to being able to cook their food, providing the energy boost needed to power a larger brain. Avoiding cooked food is therefore unnatural based on recent research.
Well, you know, I do talk about this in the book, in the fire section, the cooking hypothesis. Richard Wrangham is the anthropologist and primatologist who came up with it. And that the great boon in calories that underwrote the expansion of the human brain and the shrinking of the human gut is a key evolutionary watershed. That does suggest that cooking is now obligatory, that we cannot do well on all raw food diet. And all you have to do is point to the fact that anyone on a raw food diet is highly Vitamix dependent. They are processing their food. Otherwise, they'd spend half their waking hours chewing it.
Michael Pollan, always good to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Most recent book is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He'll be speaking about his new book at Dominican University, San Rafael, Monday, on the 20th of May at 7 p.m. It'll be at Barnes & Noble, Wednesday at El Cerrito at 7. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.